The Pulse of Prosperity. Preamble to the United Nations Charter states that we the peoples are determined, among other things, to promote better standards of life and to employ international machinery to do so. The program which follows is a report on a new concept of action to accomplish this aim. Ladies and gentlemen, United Nations Radio presents The Pulse of Prosperity.
That sound you hear is the heart of a man, the beating heart, the metronome of strength and weakness. If it be weak, the life it sustains is weakened, whether the life be that of men or nations. For nations, too, have hearts, on and beneath the segments of the earth they cover, and in the hands and minds of their people. And how beat the hearts of nations now? Adjust the stethoscope of economics for a moment and listen.
To check further recession, expenditure on arms,
instability of commodity prices.
The primary and industrial production index.
Plans.
Negotiations. Agreements.
Aid. Help, assistance. You know, we sometimes think that the historians and archaeologists today, as they dig into and interpret the life of ages past, have a relatively simple task. A fragment of an ornamented bowl, an inscription on a tomb. Break the code, so to speak, and there's the history. But their learned successors 1,000 years hence may find it a lot harder. We live in a noisy, talkative, argumentative age. Our opportunities to put our ideas and acts on record are so overwhelmingly numerous that the pros and cons, the truths and distortions of every public issue can be, and generally are, preserved for posterity in some form or another. Indeed, it's a sobering thought that some student of antiquities in the distant future may dig up a record of this very program. Just in case he does, and for our own benefit as well, we'll try and be as clear as possible in answering that question about the heartbeats of the nations today and in describing the new concept in international action. Actually, this is not too difficult. For despite the bewildering confusions of our time, there is a very clearly defined line of progress. So many have already noted it, threading its inexorable path through the alarums and conflicts, that it's hardly news anymore. Still, it can stand a lot of repetition. The United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge, repeated it not long ago during a speech he made at New Delhi.
The challenge of our times is not only political, it is also economic. We must try to help people improve their standard of life.
There lies the core and the key. While the blood of industry and agriculture and commerce flows strongly through some national arteries, nourishing the body as it can and should, in others, the heartbeat is weak. There is economic anemia manifest in many ways. Low expectation of life, low personal income, mass hunger, mass ignorance. The symptoms aren't news either, so we shan't dwell on them. The important point is that everyone today realizes, either vividly or dimly, according to the measure of his understanding, that nations now are not like one-celled organisms floating in a sea of isolation, but are the integral parts of that larger body, the world as a whole. And the world as a whole can no longer afford to contain within its corporate body parts, limbs, nations that are weak. This too has been recognized and repeated many times, by many people in many ways. Mr. Andrei Gromyko, foreign minister of the Soviet Union, for example, made the point like this when he spoke at the United Nations during the general debate at the last session of the General Assembly.
All countries, great and small, need one another to some extent. That is why the Charter calls for international cooperation in solving economic problems with which nations are faced, and why a number of organs have been established within our organization to promote the achievement of this aim.
In this context, we find the most positive and constructive phenomenon of the mid-20th century: organized international economic aid to those parts of the world body which are still weak.
Such help has played a most important part in enabling the underdeveloped countries of the world to reconstruct and expand and diversify their economies.
That was the voice of the Prime Minister of the newly independent nation, Malaya, Tengku Abdulrahman, addressing delegates to a meeting of the United Nations Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East when they gathered in Malaya's capital, Kuala Lumpur, in March this year. The Prime Minister continued,
I would like to add, however, that I believe that in the immediate future, at least, the need for such help will grow. Now, I do not mean by this that we in Asia cannot and will not do our part. On the contrary, I should be the first to assert that we must and will be ready for sacrifices in order to carry out our development plans, to diversify our economies, to establish new industries, and process more of our own materials, and so on. But for all that, I believe, it will be many years before Asian countries can generate enough capital to finance the expansion of their economies without gravely penalizing the consumption levels of masses of their population. In the meantime, we shall need even more international aid than we obtain today.
For Asia, read also Africa and Latin America. Why? Why must it be increased when the flow of economic aid and technical aid is already more than a mere trickle? What is lacking when the list of aid plans and programs, both on a bilateral and multilateral basis, is already a long one? One conspicuous answer is to be found in the fact that although all underdeveloped countries have plans to expand and diversify their economies, to industrialize, they are still mainly primary producers. Their national incomes depend upon the prices which commodities like tea and cocoa and rubber and rice fetch in the markets of the world. And these prices can vary rather alarmingly, up one day, down the next. And these variations can play havoc with any development plans the producing country may have. This problem was referred to at a recent press conference held by the UN Secretary General, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld. An Asian correspondent asked him if he could suggest some means whereby these disturbing fluctuations might be leveled off. The Secretary General replied that these fluctuations frequently cancel out the effects of direct aid. And he added,
That clearly indicates that we will not get the kind of stability concerning economic development in the regions to which we refer, short of some success in an effort to stabilize raw material prices and exports. You well know that there have been several experiments made in that field. It is a highly intricate one, and I think that we'll just have to continue these various efforts, these various experiments.
That is one aspect of the question being given priority attention. But there is another, which is now being treated with equally urgent priority. It's the aspect of technical assistance, a rather arid phrase used to describe a global adventure in the sharing of knowledge and skill. The UN Technical Assistance Program, quite apart from similar operations in such schemes as the Colombo Plan, now functions in about 100 countries and territories on an annual budget of about $31 million. However, even in this elaborate and effective fabric, there was until recently a big weakness. Mr. David Owen, Executive Secretary of the UN's Technical Assistance Board, explains.
At the moment, we are able to send out a a large army of expert advisors and technicians who were able to show governments how to improve their agriculture or public health or education or whatever it may be, and we've been able to provide a large number of fellowships for training purposes. But each one of these projects is rather small and rather short and chancy in duration. What we now need is the means to be able to spend a fair amount of money on a limited number of rather large projects, which will involve a fair investment of equipment as well as manpower and institutional resources over a period of years, where we can actually put the money on one side at the beginning to cover the whole duration of a project, where we can take a river valley development, for instance, and do all the engineering survey work which is necessary to lead up to a big scheme of capital development in such an area. Now, this is something which we simply can't do on our present resources. What we now need is the supplementary, concentrated effort on a number of important schemes.
We said just now that this was, until recently, a big weakness. By this time next year, we should be well on the way to overcoming it. The turning point was December 14, 1957, when the General Assembly of the United Nations unanimously adopted a resolution to set up a special project fund. It was a decision influenced by more than 10 years of thought on how the bedrock requirements of the underdeveloped countries might be met, how their economic pulse beats might be strengthened. Over these years, this thinking has centered on proposals to establish a special United Nations Fund for Economic Development, SUNFED, as it's been called. But the SUNFED idea has always been beset by difficulties, not the least being the view held by some of the major industrial powers, the USA and the UK among them, that before such a fund can be adequately and effectively financed, there must be some agreement on disarmament. Such an agreement would result in cuts in the present expenditure on arms, and the savings could be diverted to the purpose of SUNFED. To date, as we all know, there is no such agreement. In the light of this and other political facts of the times, the new special project fund was seen as a more highly concentrated and more immediately feasible concept. The Assembly's decision did not pronounce a death sentence for SUNFED. It came instead as a highly practical and progressive compromise. Now, what is the special fund intended to do? Well, at that meeting in Kuala Lumpur, which the Prime Minister of Malaya addressed, the UN Undersecretary for Economic and Social Affairs, Mr. Philippe Dessein, read a message to the delegates from the Secretary General. Referring to the Assembly decision, he said,
"In the course of its recent debate, it recognized that, and I quote, neither the expanded program of technical assistance nor other existing programs of the United Nations or the specialized agencies can now meet certain urgent needs which, if met, would advance the process of technical and economic and social development of the less developed countries, and in particular, would facilitate new capital investments of all types, private and public, national and international, by creating conditions which will make such investments either feasible or more effective. In order to fill this gap, the Assembly decided to establish, and I quote again, as an expansion of the existing technical assistance and development activities of the United Nations and the specialized agencies, a separate special fund which would provide systematic and sustained assistance in fields essential to the integrated technical, economic, and social development of the less developed countries." End of quotation. With the setting up of this new instrument of international cooperation, it becomes all the more important that the various parts of a highly diversified system find their proper place and their appropriate functions, and in particular, that the often artificial barriers established between our research and our operational activities be eliminated, so that all our efforts may be more directly concentrated toward the advance of economic progress.
The Assembly saw this special fund, totaling about $100 million a year, subscribed mainly on a voluntary basis by governments and others, and they attached two important principles to the resolution. They said that the fund shall be multilateral in nature. That is, it will be administered by and through the United Nations, and not on an individual nation-to-nation basis. And that its operation shall not be influenced in any way by political considerations. These two principles have already been very widely welcomed, both in countries which will probably be among the major contributors to the fund and among those which stand to benefit most from it. Ambassador Lodge of the United States, for example, has said,
"This program should be truly international, like any United Nations undertaking. The program cannot be mixed up in any way with power politics. It thus cannot be dominated by any one power. Nations cooperating in it must be able to do so without any hidden strings or any suspicion of pressure."
And here is the Prime Minister of India, Mr. Jawaharlal Nehru.
This is the right way of approaching the problem, that is, on an international scale. It puts it on a higher level and takes it away from various political considerations which, even unjustifiably, sometimes are attached to such work. That is why, as you perhaps know, we were anxious to encourage the proposal made in the United Nations for SUNFED.
Now, we've introduced the subject of this fund in a rather abstract and academic fashion. We've spoken of it so far as if it were a sort of exercise in economic theory, a textbook piece for students. It's true, of course, that the mechanics of an undertaking like this do possess this dusty quality. But the special fund's potential, in terms of human welfare, is so vast that one is not guilty of hyperbole to call it exciting. So let's look at it in this perspective. Mr. David Owen sets the scene.
When we come to the Special Projects Fund, governments will concentrate their requests on one or two important items, and these will be things like geological surveys, surveys for natural resources, the engineering survey for river valley development work, the institutes for training of public administrators, productivity centers, and research on the utilization of forest products, tropical products, and so on. In each one of which cases, there'll be a need to create an institution, to equip it, and to provide the personnel for a number of years, and to set the whole thing on its feet until the local people can take over.
Now let's get down to specifics, to the sort of project that will certainly fall within the orbit of the fund's operations. A few months ago, in Southeast Asia, a certain recording was made in an airplane. It's hardly hi-fi in quality. It doesn't in itself contain anything very unusual or unfamiliar. Yet it is directly and intimately linked with this new, exciting concept of international action. We take you to a point on the globe located 105 degrees east, 12 degrees north.
This is United Nations Radio, broadcasting from Phnom Penh, Cambodia. We are aboard a DC-3 belonging to the Royal Cambodian Air Force. In a few minutes, this plane will leave on a survey trip of the Great Lake area and the Tonle Sap areas in Cambodia. Aboard the plane is Lieutenant General Raymond A. Wheeler and his Mekong survey mission. We are now flying over the city of Phnom Penh, and to the left of us, along the dock area and beyond it, we can see the Tonle Sap River and the great Mekong River. We are going to fly the Mekong in the direction of the Great Lake. It is precisely in this area, along the Tonle Sap and the Great Lake, that the United Nations Survey Group is to investigate another project site within its plan to harness the resources of the East Asian River at the request of the four riparian countries.
The river Mekong, snow-fed in the remote mountains of Tibet, easing its mighty bulk into the warm saltiness of the South China Sea, 2,600 miles from its source. In between, a twisting reptilian giant, thundering over rapids and through canyons, sliding through forest, farmland, and desert. A fabulous giant, with an alternating capacity for life and death, which only the millions who live along its banks can ever fully understand. For centuries, these people, and in particular the 17 million of them whose homes and farms are in the lower basin of the Mekong, have been compelled to adjust their lives to the moods of the river. For part of every year, it is quiet and benevolent. Then, in the annual flood season, it throws off its complacency in an orgy of destruction. After destruction, it dozes again, and the patient people return to rebuild. In 1956, the first step to change this wasteful pattern of centuries was taken. The UN Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East made a preliminary study of the river to explore the possibilities of controlling its unharnessed power. Last year, the governments of Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and Vietnam, the four countries which share the Mekong as a common boundary, set up a committee to coordinate their investigations of the lower basin. In November, this committee asked the UN to make further technical studies to clear the way for a large and fully integrated development scheme. The immediate UN response was to appoint Lieutenant General Wheeler, the man who had organized the clearance of the Suez Canal, as head of an expert international team to carry out the survey. On November 19th, General Wheeler arrived in Bangkok. Here to indicate how the team went about its work are some extracts from its official diary.
November 19th to 28th. Meeting in Bangkok with Prime Minister of Thailand. ECFA, FAO representative, Coordination Committee, National Economic Council of Thailand.
November 28th, Bangkok to Saigon. Mode of travel, plane.
Discussions in Saigon with Agricultural Hydraulic Section, Ministry of Public Works, Vietnam. And with Minister and Secretary General of Public Works.
November 30th, Saigon to Dalat. Mode of travel, car.
Inspection of the Da Nim Hydroelectric Project.
December 2nd, Saigon, Luang Prabang, Vientiane. Mode of travel, plane.
Air inspection of the Mekong from the river mouth near Saigon to Luang Prabang in Laos.
December 3rd,
discussion.
4th, inspection. 5th,
examination.
6th, conference. 7th,
journey.
8th, 9th.
So it went for 5 weeks, observing everything from the river's youthful vigor in the Cone Falls and the Sambuk Rapids to its easy-flowing maturity in the delta south of Saigon. By December 29th, General Wheeler and his team were back in Bangkok, and the writing of the report began. This report pays tribute to the vision and cooperation of the four riparian countries. It speaks of flood control measures, irrigation, power generation, navigation. In its actual words,
the Mekong is one of the major rivers of the world and is a majestic river with great potentialities for service to Southeast Asia. Wise conservation and utilization of its waters will contribute more toward improving human welfare in the area than any other single undertaking.
But a lot more basic information is still needed before present dreams become realities.
It is obvious that the collection of the basic data required should be initiated and concentrated on the localities where it appears that worthwhile projects may be developed. Outside assistance, both financial and technical, will be required for any comprehensive development scheme of the lower basin.
Already such assistance has been and is being offered. At the March meeting of ECFA in Kuala Lumpur, Monsieur Negrier of France said his country had been the first to give financial aid and would continue to give it. Mr. Green of New Zealand said his country would give 2 survey ships to each of the 4 riparian countries. Mr. Ohotin of the Soviet Union said his country was ready to help plan and build hydroelectric power schemes, either directly to the 4 countries or through the agency of EKFE. But it is in that phrase, the collection of basic data, that we find ourselves at the heart of the whole matter, at the pulse. We said at the beginning of this program that nations have hearts on and beneath the segments of the earth they cover, and in the hands and minds of their people. Some of these hearts are weak, because among many contributing factors, there is often a lack of knowledge of the basic natural resources of a country, of its potential wealth. And there is often a lack, too, of trained human skill to exploit those resources. Hence, the urgent need for the Special Projects Fund to do vital spade work like the Mekong Survey. Mr. David Owen, Executive Chairman of the UN Technical Assistance Board, adds the penultimate thought. Technical assistance, he says, has been successful, but
people realize that something more is now needed, and I think governments are committed to that view. Though to what extent, of course, they will back their commitment by hard cash remains to be seen. I think it is important that they should respond generously, for in a small but, I believe, constructive way, we're helping to build tomorrow's world.
The General Assembly set January 1st, 1959, as the date on which the special fund should begin to pump its tonic stream into the arteries which need it most. Details have been worked out by a 16-nation preparatory committee.
The committee recommends that control of policy and operations should be exercised by a governing council of 18 members, drawn equally from developed and underdeveloped countries. This council would have the final authority in deciding whether or not a project should be aided by the fund, and a managing director would be appointed to receive requests submitted by governments and to recommend them for the council's consideration. The committee expressed its views on factors which should influence the governing council in giving its approval to a project. It said, for example, that the urgency of the needs of a requesting country should be considered, and that any project undertaken should lead to early results and have the widest possible impact in advancing the economic, social, or technical development of a country. A type of project which would open the way for new capital investment would be considered particularly desirable and important. The committee also made some recommendations on the basic fields of assistance which may be covered by the special fund. They listed natural resources, industry, and not only highly mechanized industry, but handicrafts and cottage operations as well, agriculture, transport and communications, building and housing, health and education, statistics and public administration. All of them vital elements in the complex organization of a modern society. The full report of the preparatory committee will be discussed later this year by the UN's Economic and Social Council, and at the end of the year, by the General Assembly.
If this report is finally approved, the prospect will be a pulse of prosperity that will gradually beat with greater strength in every part of this corporate body, the world.
You have just heard The Pulse of Prosperity, an account of a new international step towards universal welfare. The program was narrated by Eugene Kern and written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio.